Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Some of our customers at the farmers market and even some of our CSA members, as they say, oh, you're certified now? And there's a little bit of a question mark at the end of their statement.
Candace Minster of the White Violet Center for Eco Justice. We talked to her about the process of securing USDA organic certification and how she hopes it'll help them stand out from other producers. Strawberry season is here and will be gone before you know it. Make Jackie Howard's strawberry bread pudding before it's too late. We meet a farmer who has adapted to life with a prosthetic arm. Pesticides in the pot industry and what regulators are and aren't doing about it. Those stories from Harvest Public Media. And you can borrow a dehydrator and some garden tools from Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. What's in the news with Luann Johnson?
We have three stories of interest this week, Annie. Monsanto has made a $45 billion offer for the Swiss pesticide and seed company Syngenta, an offer Syngenta has so far rejected. The first offer to create the world's largest seed and pesticide supplier came from Monsanto in May. Syngenta said the proposal didn't take into consideration, quote, the significant execution risks, including regulatory and public scrutiny at multiple levels in many countries, unquote. Monsanto, on the other hand, has offered to sell Syngenta's seed operations, should the company accept its offer, in an effort to appease antitrust regulators. It also claims it will shed some of its Americanness by changing the newly formed company's name and moving the headquarters to London. Monsanto reported $15.9 billion in sales in 2014. Syngenta took in $15.1 billion. French supermarkets will be required to donate unused food to charities or turn it into animal feed under a new law aimed at curbing food waste. The French National Assembly passed a law in May that would hand down penalties of more than $80,000 or 2 years in jail for throwing away edible food that is damaged or past the sell-by date. Other food waste would be sent to farms to feed livestock. The French government estimates that the average citizen throws away more than 60 pounds of edible food each year, nearly a quarter of which is still in its packaging, for an overall cost of up to $22.5 billion. And Dunkin' Donuts is testing a mobile app that would allow consumers with a donut craving to summon a dozen right to their door. Dunkin' Brand's CEO Nigel Travis told CNBC that the company is testing software privately and would launch a mobile ordering system sometime next year. Starbucks is testing a phone delivery app in the Northwest, and McDonald's and Chipotle have launched pilot programs in New York City. Health advocates are concerned about the effect of increasing access to junk food. Michelle Simon, public health lawyer and president of Eat Drink Politics, said fast food delivery makes it much harder for consumers to peruse healthy choices.
You know, parents have a hard enough time as it is, a tired parent driving home and the kids nagging in the back seat for stopping at McDonald's. Well, now if that same child can nag, to simply pull up an app to get Dunkin' Donuts delivered at the door. I mean, parents don't need one more reason to say no.
Simon said the company's push for more convenience is an act of desperation against droopy sales and growing desire for better food.
To me, what it shows us is that these companies are hurting. And the analysis, the trade papers tell us every day that there are companies like McDonald's and Campbell's Soup and all the conventional, junk food companies are really losing market share.
Dunkin' Brands, which includes Baskin-Robbins, reported slow fourth-quarter sales last year at 1.4% compared to 3.5% growth the year before. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie for reporting these stories. Read more at eartheats.org.
We talk about these stories and so many more on Twitter every day. Join us at Earth Eats. Luann, thank you for joining us. Till next week.
You got it.
The marijuana industry has a pesticide problem. Many commercial cannabis growers use chemicals to control bugs and mold, but because of the plant's unresolved legal status, regulators are having a tough time making sure pot buyers don't ingest those pesticides. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
This grow room at Medical MJ Supply in Fort Collins, Colorado, has all the trappings of your modern marijuana cultivation facility. glowing yellow lights, plastic irrigation tubes, and rows of knee-high cannabis plants. Nick Dice is the owner.
We're seeing a crop that's in probably its third to fourth week of bloom right now.
The plants are vibrantly green, happy, and healthy. And Dice says that's because the company's taken a hard line on cleanliness.
We have people that's their only job is to look for any infections or anything that could cause potential damage to the crop.
As any farmer will tell you, damage to the crop equals damage to the bottom line. Dice says his grow site has never seen widespread pestilence. But before he started an intense disinfectant routine, a regimen of mild chemicals kept cannabis pests under control.
We would switch between, you know, multiple pesticides and mildew treatments, and we would try and treat anywhere from every 3 to 4 days, honestly.
Dice says he's seen other operations crumble as their cannabis succumbs to an outbreak of powdery mildew, which coats the plant's leaves. Or fall victim to two-spot spider mites that feast on its stems and reproduce like crazy. Pest controls ensure a good yield. And when it comes to cannabis, yields really matter. How much do you think that this room is worth?
Oh, Lord. I'd have to count some plants really quick. See, 160 to 180,000.
Yeah, that's $180,000. Protecting that yield is hard work. That's why many growers use chemicals. But it's the federal government that tells farmers which pesticides are safe to use. And so far, the feds want nothing to do with legalized marijuana. Colorado State University entomologist Whitney Cranshaw says that's left growers to experiment with little oversight.
In the absence of any direction, the subject of pesticide use on the crop has just devolved to whatever people think is working or they think is appropriate.
Tobacco farmers, for example, have a stable of pesticides the government says is safe to use. But Cranshaw says marijuana growers have none.
Sometimes they've used some things that are inappropriate, sometimes unsafe.
Anybody can get their hands on harmful chemicals and they can just spray away all the way up until the last day of harvest.
Brett Eaton is a plant expert with American Cannabis Company, a Denver-based consulting group.
And, you know, what is that doing to the product and what is that doing to the consumer who's consuming that product?
Those same safety concerns led Denver officials to place a hold on tens of thousands of marijuana plants earlier this spring. An investigation is underway. Ultimately, pesticide enforcement is up to state agriculture officials. They recently released a list of pesticides deemed appropriate for use on cannabis. Washington State and Illinois have similar lists. Eaton says regulators are playing catch-up.
Other agricultural industries already have policy in place for the safe use of spraying certain pesticides and fungicides. This being a new industry, it hasn't been addressed yet.
But as marijuana use and cultivation becomes more mainstream, this is one issue regulators will have to address, Eaton says. And with more states turning marijuana into a commodity crop, it'll take a mix of policy, science, and industry self-regulation to figure out what's appropriate and what's not. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Later on today, we meet a farmer who's made it work with a prosthetic arm. Another story from Harvest. The garden at the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice is usually a very peaceful place, serene even. It's 5 acres on the campus of St. Mary of the Woods in West Central Indiana, a ministry of the Sisters of Providence. But there was one day this past spring when garden manager Candace Minster was uncharacteristically stressed.
Yeah, I was worked up getting to it. I wanted to have everything in order.
An inspector was visiting the gardens that day.
I think I was so nervous because I just had no idea what to expect.
He was there to check everything out and then make a recommendation on whether the White Violet Center should be granted USDA certified organic status. This was a new experience for Minster, but the gardens had been certified before. Sister Ann Sullivan founded the White Violet Center in 1996. She herself grew up on an organic farm. Sullivan reclaimed the land from the local family who had been farming it. And making that land certified organic was just in line with the mission of the center.
But also the concern was that at the time, the sisters' water that they would drink, were it was from their own wells, and some of the farm chemicals that were used on the land were ending up in their wells and in their drinking water.
So it was both a human and an environmental health concern. Over the next 12 years, they sold most of the harvest at the Terre Haute Farmers Market and through their community-supported agriculture program. They realized that the USDA certification didn't mean much to their customers.
But a lot of consumers were saying things like, oh, I trust you, or oh, I know you don't use any chemicals out there. And so it didn't seem like the seal of certified organic was the most important thing.
They surrendered the organic certification in 2008. It was a cost-saving decision, too. But nothing changed about how they actually grew the food. Same organic techniques without the requirement to take detailed notes on everything happening on the farm. On the marketplace side, one thing they did notice was a change in the price they received for their food on the wholesale market.
When you are selling your organically grown produce wholesale, you need to be able to prove that you are indeed using organic methods in order for a buyer to pay that organic premium. When we would do a few wholesales here and there, we were getting pretty much just a conventional rate for that product, even though it was a higher quality product and there was a lot of extra labor that went into it because it was indeed organic.
There was a convergence of things that were happening at once that caused us to reexamine organic certification.
That's Lori Heber, director of the White Violet Center. She says they noticed an increase in wholesale options for organics. Walmart and Kroger could be customers, she said. They are also looking ahead to the opening of Terra Foods, a co-op that's slated to start selling food in 2016. All the new markets also meant new growers.
We have a fair number of producers in our marketplace now, where once upon a time we were one of a handful. Now there are dozens and dozens.
Another important factor: the USDA introduced its organic certification cost share programs in 2015.
So that's brought the cost of obtaining an organic certification down tremendously. So for instance, our certification process cost us just under $1,000, and the USDA will reimburse us up to $750 of that. So it makes it an affordable option.
They started the ball rolling in September of last year by meeting with a rep from a certifying operation. Minster then spent much of December and January pulling together an organic systems plan.
That is a fancy way of saying the certifying agencies and the USDA want to learn about how you farm. They want to know what it is you're planting, what kinds of amendments you might be using. It feels a little daunting when you first look at all the documents that you're asked to complete.
Luckily, Minster had kept detailed notes on the farming operation, so she already had much of the information she needed on hand. In fact, when the inspector came to visit that day, he complimented White Violet on their record keeping. Their first USDA certified organic produce was sold in May of this year. Minster and Heber hope it will help them stand out in an increasingly crowded market. They're having different conversations now with their customers.
Some of our customers at the farmers market and even some of our CSA members, as they say, oh, you're certified now? And there's a little bit of a question mark at the end of their statement. And as I have emphasized, our growing practices never changed. Even though we voluntarily surrendered our certification in 2008, all of our practices were still basically as though we were certified. Some of the bits of paperwork and record keeping did relax because we didn't have someone wanting to look at our compost temperature logs, for instance.
Candace Minster is the garden manager at the White Violet Center for Eco Justice, and Lori Heber is the director. We've got pictures of the beautiful gardens on our website and lots of great organic gardening advice. EarthEats.org. Coming up, Coming up, Stephanie Solomon says it's not enough to teach people how to cook or how to grow their own food.
But often one of the central barriers for people actually going home and cooking from scratch, preserving food, canning, breaking ground on a home garden, is having the tools that they need to actually get started.
Mother Hubbard's Cupboard is trying to fill that gap with their Tool Share program. We'll hear more about it in 10 minutes. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. I'm in the kitchen with executive chef at Indiana University's Alpha Z Delta Sorority, Jackie Howard. She reaches for a ketchup bottle and gives a good squeeze into the mixing bowl. Normally no big deal, but this recipe is for strawberry bread pudding.
It's vanilla.
Ketchup bottles filled with vanilla make sense in a kitchen that specializes in sweet treats. During recruitment weeks for the sorority, Howard can work up to 75 hours preparing special snacks.
Let's see, this year we did vanilla bean marshmallows, strawberry swirl cheesecake, which we used the Dillman Farm strawberry jam for that. Oh, we did rose meringue cookies, pink and white pinwheel sugar cookies, and then we did the French vanilla soda in the champagne glasses. Mm-hmm. It was really pretty.
Howard's team does also make breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the sorority women during the school year. She sources as many ingredients as she can from local farmers and producers. This strawberry bread pudding is a good example of that. She's beating 6 eggs from Heartland Family Farm. She's mixing in strawberries that are also from Heartland.
We cooked it down with just a little bit of sugar and added it to the custard for the bread pudding.
Much of the bread, also locally sourced. She says this is a great recipe for using up slightly stale bits and leftovers.
We use all kinds of bread. We use scholar's bread, but we also do, you know, leftover pastries and cinnamon rolls and all kinds of things into bread pudding. And so we're pouring this over, and what's going to happen, we're going to press it and leave it overnight to soak up all of the goodness. And then top it in the morning with a homemade streusel, because I love the crunch that it adds.
That's oats with some cinnamon and cardamom. She also includes a dollop of some sweet goat cheese and more reduced strawberries. It's a thing of beauty. Check out the picture along with the recipe at eartheats.org. Howard takes pride in her work in this kitchen.
You know, I think that this institutional cooking has a bad rap sometimes. And I think that a lot of chefs wouldn't take what we do seriously.
But she's trying to change that perception because, as she says, everyone deserves good food made from scratch from good ingredients. We'll feature Jackie Howard again in a couple weeks when she's off work in the summer months. She runs the food truck Bee's Soda Bar. Their root beer recipe is amazing, and she'll make it for us. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes so you don't miss a single recipe. Just search for Earth Eats.
When it comes to hazardous work industries, farming is in the top three, with transportation and warehousing and mining. And many times after an accident, farmers end up as amputees. But as Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports, when farmers and ranchers lose a limb on the job, they have a limited selection of prosthetics to help them get back to the fields.
Joseph Burris is the director of amputee rehabilitation at the University of Missouri Columbia. He works with many agriculture workers with amputations. The leading cause is diabetes, but right behind that is trauma. Farmers and ranchers who have had horrific run-ins with equipment.
While it's terrible to see the impact that amputation has on people, it is inspiring repeatedly to see people overcome some of their difficulties and have success.
According to the National Safety Council, one out of every 10 ag injuries results in amputation. Burris helps farmers work with the new prosthesis meant to assist them when returning to the field. Devices today can plug into the electric signals in your muscles, and you can control their movement. The problem is, they are really expensive.
Terminal devices can run up $75,000, $80,000, and prosthetic devices, I know recently we had one quoted for nearly $200,000. So the prices are astronomical at this point with the technology.
Farmer Brian Fleshman lost part of his right arm in 1996. He still farms today, just outside of Jefferson City, Missouri. On a recent spring day, he's washing up at a spigot near his hen house.
Yeah, I was working in the garden just now, planting a little sweet corn. I continue to try to do everything I used to do before the accident, I'll be honest with you. It takes me a lot longer, and it's a lot harder on me.
Instead of a prosthetic hand, Fleshman has what's called a farmer's hook on his right arm. It's not flashy. It's simple, and one of the cables connecting to the hook is fraying. The hook opens and closes, and it connects to his limb with the harness he wears around his shoulders. 20 years ago, he was harvesting corn when some of the stalks choked up the machine that separates the ears and the stalks. That's when he reached into the machine to clear it out while it was still rutting, just like he had many times before.
That day, for some reason, it got me. And I mean, it took the whole hand through before you could spit. And then it was a fight to try to keep from being drugged on in by the rollers.
Once Fleshman had recovered from his accident, he was fitted for a prosthetic because he wanted to get back to the field. But his fancy tool acted up and didn't fit well on his limb. Over time, like many farmers, he's adopted the traditional farmer's hook. He found it more reliable, affordable, and durable than the more technologically advanced device.
Clearly, farmers work in unique environments.
Stefania Fatone is an associate professor at Northwestern University.
Their devices are exposed to dust. They're working outdoors. They're exposed to farm chemicals, which often can be corrosive or unfriendly to the devices.
Fatone studied prosthetic use with farm workers and says many farmers find their prosthetics hard to handle in demanding work conditions. She says since farmers tend to live in rural areas, it's not always cost-effective to take a day away from the fields to drive to town for a tune-up.
You couldn't get anybody to offer me enough money to get rid of this.
Since his injury, Fleshman has received help from the group AgriAbility, a program that helps disabled farmers and ranchers succeed in agriculture. For Fleshman, that meant buying him a small tractor to help with the work. He says he's also received a lot of help from his family and neighbors. But without his right arm or a more robust device that can help with the work, he's stuck doing the best he can.
My life ended that day, right there in the field. The life that I knew. It was over.
For him, that meant starting his new life with an old tool. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Visit their website for more stories of food and farming, harvestpublicmedia.org. Mother Hubbard's Cupboard goes by a few nicknames in the Bloomington community, MHC, Mother Hubbard's, but the nickname they like the best is The Hub. That's because they want to be more than just an emergency food pantry. They want to be the community resource center for all things food. They open at noon for customers to go shopping. Around this time last year, on another warm June morning, a line was already starting to form, 4, 5, and now 6 people deep. In addition to food assistance, they offer cooking and gardening classes in their kitchen and their gardens. One day you can learn how to preserve food. The next day it's worm composting and container gardening.
I'm Kate Young, Nutrition Education Coordinator at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
I'm Stephanie Solomon. I'm the Director of Education and Outreach at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
One of the newest programs at the Hub is its Tool Share program. Patrons can borrow cooking equipment and garden tools for no cost. Community members can take advantage of their tool library for a small fee.
We offer these great cooking and gardening classes, but often one of the central barriers for people actually going home and cooking from scratch, preserving food, canning, breaking ground on a home garden is having the tools that they need to actually get started.
Young teaches cooking classes at the Hub, and she tries to keep it pretty basic.
But it is true that there are a few kitchen tasks, especially the larger scale like canning and dehydrating, that do require special tools, or they make the job easier.
The dehydrator in particular has been really popular so far.
We've demonstrated it a few times. We've done banana chips in there. We've done apples, and people have sampled them, and then they've been like, I want to borrow this.
That dehydrator would probably retail for around $100. Looking on the shelves in the kitchen where the tools live, the water bath canning kits take up the most room. Young says people are eager to learn about canning, but the initial investment and then the space required to store the equipment can make it intimidating.
So this was a kit that kind of came with everything you would need. And so it's got the special jar lifter, which is pretty important, and there's a funnel that is also really helpful for getting the product into the jar without making a huge mess, little magnetic lid lifter, and a colander. So just all the things that you would need to can your own fresh produce.
Barriers. Young and Solomon talk a lot about breaking down barriers. Just getting people to come to the Hub to shop or take classes or borrow tools, that's perhaps the most important barrier of them all to break down. They do that by not requiring folks to prove their need to shop at the food pantry.
We have always operated on an honor system, so it's kind of part of the culture of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. And I feel like many of the people who use our services already kind of have that understanding.
Which is perhaps why every tool has been returned to the Hub in the same condition in which it was lent. Learn more about the amazing work they do at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard at mhcfoodpantry.org. Details about their tool share program at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Stephanie Solomon, Kate Young, Betsy Shepherd, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Okay, Earth Eats in the books for another week. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.